that.
Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about boron. Can you get too much of a good thing? In our spotlight, we'll take a look at two entrepreneurs who have developed a solution for Japanese beetle control. Ag History Minute, we'll talk the history of plant nutrition. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomber.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomber.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Well, I hope you guys brought your kayaks if you're scouting around here today, because we got a deluge of rain last night. Just seems to be fairly localized to our area.
It's been very localized in general, it seems like, this spring. Some areas,
yeah, even
the saying when it rains, it pours, I think is very adequate, appropriate, yep. Yes.
Yeah. Now, driving around yesterday, it was like hitting patches of heavy rain, and then you'd get a little further and the road was dry, and then you'd hit rain again, and it was kind of all over, but late last night, like it was 6:30, somewhere in there, we just got hammered.
Yeah, so the certain areas got nothing, and that was a hard one. I think guys were planting through the night to get knowing, like, oh, it's going to rain.
Right.
And then I know areas where they got very little rain, they still had a break, but they did say, like, man, we were pushing it to get done ahead of that rain, and it didn't come. But in general, they got a little bit. So something, it's been odd, though. The soil conditions of spring, difficult. I mean, it's dry on top, wet underneath, and just spotty certain areas where you'd think would be fine or not, in certain areas that you'd think would be able to go, can't. So it's just been one of those springs where you feel like you're battling it. Not like the battle of 2019 battle, but just still where we're getting just enough, like, it always feels like we're a day away from really being ready, and then it rains that day. So
yeah,
it's been kind of a struggle. And then first crop hay, when that always comes and is ready, that's the true, like, okay, should we be doing first crop? Should we? What?
Usually rain, like yesterday, comes right after the first guy cuts.
Yes. Actually, there was a few guys cutting, kind of. Not a lot, though, but yeah, where that first time.
Mother Nature sniffs that out, like, oh, you think you're going to get your hay off on time? Nope.
No.
Let me rain all over it. But yeah, a lot of rye came off in the last week here. So that was kind of the precursor to that first cutting of alfalfa. And now, I don't know, looking at the peak scissor clips versus the lab tests, it's I don't know what you guys have been seeing, but there's not a lot of buds, but it's tall.
Yep.
There's really tall plants.
Buds are just starting, that we noticed, and yep. I think this weekend we're supposed to get, you know, in the mid-80s. They'll come now, but at the same time, it does not seem... For the height of alfalfa, it was not maturing much this in 1 week, which was probably good. Yeah, it'll probably help us a lot in a way, and help, you know, that it won't turn to sort of brush on us really quick. But I think when we get into later, the 20th of May to the 30th, it's going to mature fairly quickly.
I blame Canada.
For the wildfire smoke, yep. That's holding there.
Yep.
This is cool mornings and smoky at times.
Well, yeah. This morning we have fog. As I can barely see the field that's like 20 yards out the window. So, yeah, that moisture is just kind of hanging in the air this morning.
But, yeah, right when most guys are thinking about cutting, there's like 60 to 30% chances of rain every day for like that full week. So,
seems like that's how it's been the last 2 weeks, though. Like,
right.
Every other day there's a chance, and some days we get, some days we don't.
It's going to be tricky cutting hay, when to pull the trigger, how to do it where it just gets the least amount of rain on it.
Yeah, it's kind of that catch-22 of depending on how much rain we get. It's going to keep you out of the field that much longer. So, yeah, it'd be interesting. Always is.
Yeah, always. Except that is one thing about 2023, the drought, if we want to call it that, was you could...
Hay windows aplenty.
Yeah, you could spray.
It may not have grown since last cut, but
like
it may not have worked, but you could do it.
And we had a couple just timely enough rains that
In some areas, yeah.
But again,
first and second were all right. Third is where we kind of saw the
hit. Oh, yeah. Third got hit bad. But, like, I'm just saying there was no. Yeah, you could at least go harvest it easily.
Yeah, there's not many years where you could make dry hay every cut, pretty much.
Right.
But, yeah. Did you guys see the Packers release video for the schedule this year?
I did. It had nothing to do with the schedule.
What's a release video of schedule? What do you?
Do you remember the Titans one from last year where they?
I know that's a thing now where they're doing
they like
this.
Man on the street, like they'd show logos and
okay.
So the one girl was like, she saw the Falcons and she said Red Stallions or something. It's a thing. You got to watch it.
Okay.
It's quite funny. This year's for the Titans is not as funny as last year's.
But yeah, for the Packers, they had Jordan Love, Jerry Alexander, and
Preston Smith. And The Rock.
As like, yeah, and Larry McCarron with his
I thought you funky meant like, pinky.
Not The Rock.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Just shut up. As like a panel looking at audition tapes.
Okay.
And so then it was people like
Mikowski.
Don Mikowski, the magic man. He showed up and was doing like magic tricks.
Okay. What were they auditioning for?
I don't even remember what they were auditioning for?
No.
But they had Barstool Big Cat. Nice. He's just like, I hate you guys. They'd bleep him out and then put the bear symbol over his mouth as he was swearing it. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting. Who's the guy from ESPN that's from Green Bay?
Demoski.
No. That was on Wipeout. Anderson.
Yeah. Anderson.
Or John Anderson. Not Dan Anderson. That's a plumber.
Yes.
Shout out to Dan Anderson.
Hey, Dan. You do great work. John Anderson was on there. The little shtick, and then they had other players too, that like Elton Jenkins, and
he did like a Bob Ross kind of
painting. But yeah, and then at the end they showed like the full schedule.
They weren't revealing the schedule. I thought maybe Big Cat told who like they were playing the Bears or something.
He just was swearing at the Packer fans because they get their butts kicked.
But yeah, The Don Mikowski one was the one that, for me, came out of left field. Like, to just randomly have Magic Man show up was... Like, everybody else kind of made sense.
I mean, Mikowski makes sense. He's an old pack.
No, but I mean, like... But
you just... Did you recognize him right away, or did they put his name?
They put his name right away. Because I don't think anybody was... And he was dressed goofy, too.
Okay.
Like, this weird, like, magician's outfit on. But yeah, I guess... I know who Don Mikowski is. I remember him playing when I was a kid, but... Just the, like, that's a deep pull for quarterback to bring in for this kind of thing.
What I heard was, like, if you were national person, like just a random person in California watching this video, you'd go, like, who the heck are half these people?
Right, you wouldn't know any of them.
But because of, if you follow the Packers, you're going to know 90% of them.
Right, they're all either from Green Bay or have a Wisconsin tie in some case, like, you know, Big Cat. Went to Madison.
So yeah,
and he's a sports personality. So yeah, it was just kind of a neat little montage because they had that one comedian guy too. He's all over X, Tom Grossi. He would do like videos weekly after games, like reactions to Fan of the Year or something.
Yeah, like Packer Fan of the Year or NFL Fan of the Year or something. You'll have to watch.
But yeah, like you said, Bill, people in California would be like, who are these people?
Right.
Especially probably most of the Packer players since they're all so young. But Erin Andrews was on there too. She was one of the people. But I don't think she was auditioning. She was just like making commentary.
Yeah.
Oh, Joe Buck. They had Joe Buck.
Joe Buck? Who's that? Oh,
yeah.
He's like, I love the Packers.
So yeah. No, it was like a half like local crowd and then they were...
Yeah, Erin Andrews and Joe Buck, everybody would know them.
Right. But I mean, everybody else.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Unless they were alive to watch Don Mikowski play. But it was interesting. So yeah, the full schedule is out now. So we get the Brazil game, a home game on Thanksgiving, which is kind of unique.
That's very unique. It's either always like Cowboys, you know, we're going to play the Lions or the Cowboys on Thanksgiving. So, yeah, that'll be cool.
Yeah, so another Midwest home game besides Detroit.
The interesting part was all the gold package games are the home divisional games. The Milwaukee crowd got all divisional home games. Thought that was interesting.
I was surprised how long it takes to get a divisional game, too. Like, a lot of them seem to be packed in the back half.
Yeah.
Because, like, the Bears, we don't play till November.
We play the Vikings early, which is good.
Yeah.
They've been doing that now, is backloading divisional games, because you got a better chance of that being a playoff.
Yeah.
Because we play implication that if
our first game against the Bears is November.
Yeah, that is late.
And then they're our last game of the season.
Just nice we get the Vikings early, because they aren't going to have their quarterback thing figured out, probably.
Right.
At least the one game
I think
is early.
We get them at the end again.
Yeah, we get them later, too. But
yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
They get the Lions on Thursday, but not Thanksgiving. It's like the week after Thanksgiving, or the week before, I forget. But that was...
So who do we play on Thanksgiving? Because it's
the
always...
Dolphins.
Oh, that's even weird, too, isn't
it's
it?
It's that night game. They always...
Sure, really just the random night game. Yeah, okay.
Yep. Which is probably good to slide the Dolphins in on Thanksgiving when it's going to be chilly.
It's going to be a tough stretch there of the Thanksgiving, because you got Niners before that, then Dolphins, and then Lions at Lions. Like, you're going to have a tough...
I've heard that three times now, Todd, of people talking about that.
Oh, is it really? Okay, yeah. No, I'm just briefly looking at it like, oof, that could be, hopefully you get one win or two wins out of those three, you'd be setting all right.
You got to go back to Seattle. Fail Mary.
Yeah, and we always December. Don't play well there.
No.
Got the Niners right before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that'll be a gauntlet right there.
Yeah. All right, you guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Let's do it.
So, about 2 years ago, we did a whole series of episodes on micronutrients.
Was that long ago?
It was that long ago.
It just feels like yesterday.
Yeah, it does. And that was actually one of our better series, you know, where you kind of just, you'd think it'd be more boring, I guess, because you're talking about one micronutrient, but.
Sometimes we were talking about a couple.
We did. We grouped them at times, too. But it was.
We combined molybdenum with some other stuff.
Yep.
Selenium.
The thing that they lack in Michigan. But yeah, so episode 121, and we're on this one today that we're recording is 237. So we talked about boron, and it came up again recently. So before we recorded, we were talking. So I've got a farm that wants to try something I heard on a podcast from a regenerative ag guy, and it's adding calcium and boron to soybeans right before they flower. And when he kind of approached the concept of it, he's like, yeah, let's just try it. And he wants to do it in a plot format, which is good. So he's not like just doing the whole field. He's going to try a couple different variations on how much boron, how much calcium. We're going to do dry product, not foliar. And so it kind of got me thinking about boron again. Like, it's not really something we do a lot with. I mean, it's become more common to have boron, like in certain situations, but it's not one of those where like, oh yeah, boron, that's what we're missing.
Boron's tricky micronutrients because it's not an afterthought, but it's not a macronutrient on the forethought either.
Right.
You know, obviously if you had to rank them, you'd rank, you know, even in the micronutrient realm, I guess, but sulfur, you'd think about ahead of
even zinc to
boron,
some degree.
Zinc, yeah. And so boron gets you, I mean, I think more in alfalfa that I've been seeing that we're using boron, you know, with the Spire and some of these other products that have it blended with potash. So I guess what you're saying too, specific to soybeans, I mean, I think of manganese in soybeans even before boron. So
yeah, potash, manganese, sulfur,
so
everything.
That's a very unique one. And then what else is sort of unique about it is you also, with boron, you got to worry about the toxicity side as well. So there's both sides. So, and I won't jump the gun on you, Matt, if we're getting to that.
Yeah, but we'll touch on that too.
But there's a tricky part with that nutrient of like, you know, and I know that's right where your title comes from, too much of a good thing. But I think there's something to think about with boron is like you want some, but not too much. So it's getting that just right porridge feel to it. Not too hot, not too cold, just right.
Yeah. And that's kind of where the conversation led to is like, okay, boron toxicity, like how much is too much? Are we, you know, how much do we put out to make it make sense that we're not going crazy? So to hearken back to a couple of years ago when we talked about boron, just as a quick, I guess, reminder primer for our listeners, it's a micronutrient that is immobile in the plant, but very mobile in the soil. So it can leach out of the soil fairly quickly. So in that way, it's like sulfur and nitrogen. It's one of those things that can cycle fairly fast in the soil, not so much in the plant. And as far as sufficiency ranges go, it's not really considered a high volume type thing that you need in the soil. So, you know, your very low is, depending on soil type, 0.2 to 0.5 parts per million, up to excessively high is 2.5 to 4 parts. So it's not a huge range as far as what we know of a sufficiency range. So it can be very tricky to kind of dial that in. So I looked up, you know, found some research that's been done in this realm. And so basically boron's an essential micronutrient that we know. It's been known for a century. But its role in plant metabolism is still being debated. So primary function is cell wall synthesis. So maintaining structure and integrity. Amount of boron in the wall depends on plant species, the organ, and the boron supply. And also plays a role in enzyme reactions, so transport of ions, metabolites, and hormones in the plant. So what do we know about boron is a big question. I mean, we know it's part of the plant, but we don't know how much we really need it there for some things. Boron deficiency affects photosynthesis and transport of photosynthetic products, so things the plant makes. So that, again, too, if you have a deficiency versus toxicity, it can be a fine line of where you are on that scale.
I think one thing to be specific to is boron is mostly in dicotyledonous plants, so in your dicots, so your broadleaves, but alfalfa, soybeans, it tends to be more of a, plays a bigger role than in grasses like corn. But however, we know boron's very important in corn at times too.
Yep.
And I think we've added,
right,
added applications of boron over the years,
right,
you know, with more aerial application and different timings of products, we're adding boron in quite a bit more.
When you look at the corn growers plots and the corn warrior guys, they tend to add at least some boron to corn. So it's not just alfalfa, it's being done in other plants too. You know, there's been foliar boron around for a while that could be applied. Like you said, it's interesting that depending on species, it can really make a big difference.
It matters more. And then a couple of places you can get it besides fertilizer is soil organic matter is a primary source of boron. So The higher amount of organic matter you have, you're probably going to have more boron available. And then, you know, from dairy manure or just manure in general, you're going to get boron as well. Typically, dairy manure, you're going to get kind of that half a pound of boron, you know, in your normal 15,000-gallon rate. So that'd be enough to cover you for that year and usually take care of any sort of problems you might have with it too. So I think that's sort of a thing to look at as well, is what are my organic matter levels? Am I using another source like manure where I could be getting enough of this micronutrient? And then say on the years that you're not applying manure, maybe you apply a little bit more boron on those years or at specific timings as well. So,
yeah. Well, and timing, I'm glad you brought that up because it's interesting to me when I looked more into the boron deficiency side. I think the timing of the boron can play an effect too, because so in this research article that I was reading, they said in maize or corn, tomato, carrot, alfalfa, excess boron decreases emergence. So having too much at the start can actually affect your emergence of the plant. So you could have, by having too much, you could mess up how the plant even starts life.
That's interesting, Matt, because think of our starters or in-furrows or pop-ups or two-by-twos, and we don't talk about boron at all in those. Yep. And obviously that's why. It's because it's, you know, there your zinc or some, you know, obviously phosphorus play a bigger role. So that is interesting that the timing is important on this product of trying to get it later. And that also goes to, like, corn. I think a lot of it, where it started in trying to get higher yielding corn, started in tissue sampling. And you'd start to see, you know, that ear leaf sampling time of tissue that boron would be deficient in a lot of samples. And you'd go, well, holy, okay, you know, how can we get into that plant at that timing? And it's difficult, but like you say, it rarely shows up on a younger corn plant as being boron deficient. It always kind of shows up later.
Yeah. So when you get into the fertilization side of boron, and specific to the scenario we were talking about before, so this applying the boron to soybeans, part of what was presented in this idea was the fact that supposedly, and I couldn't find a lot of research on this, that calcium is made more available by having boron. So the higher your boron levels, that's supposed to help make the calcium more available. What I could find on the fertilization side is that calcium and boron help promote flower retention and pod fixation. And this was kind of part of the argument for the plot that we're doing, was that it's supposed to help increase yield by putting out the calcium, whether it's calcium carbonate or calcium sulfate and boron, at that flowering time to help promote more flowers, more pods, and increase yield.
That time of year too, flower retention, you know, weather starts to turn. I mean, we're going to have a nice hot weekend here, but again, at that point, you know, we're mid-June, late June into July, right, when we're flowering. So if we can do anything to help retain those flowers when we get those hot days, I can see where we're going to have more pods potentially.
Right. So that's kind of the reasoning behind putting in there. And like you said, Todd, we do boron and alfalfa. Alfalfa is a legume. Soybeans are legumes. So there is kind of a species connection there that kind of makes sense when we look into this. And then another thing I found related to the combination of calcium and boron is that having the calcium there with the boron can help mitigate toxicity symptoms of the boron. So it does kind of lend itself. So it's not a direct link to boron making calcium more available, but kind of a flip-flop of calcium kind of calms down the toxicity symptoms of the boron. So the two of them together seem to be make more sense to me, looking at some of this research that's been done, as opposed to just boron by itself. So there is some potential to this idea, but it's still kind of a question mark of how much is too much, what's the right, you know, combination. And so in the plot, we're going to do some varying rates of boron, varying rates of calcium, and see, you know, if we can find a sweet spot. Do we see toxicity? Do we have issues in the plant? And so we're going to monitor through the year. The application will be prior to flowering, so somewhere, you know, around the summer solstice, to kind of get that in that target range of helping the flowers and set pods. So one other research thing I found is that somewhere between 2 and 2.5 pounds of actual boron is kind of the level, application level at which you hit that line of going from adequate boron to toxicity. And that was, I think, out of Michigan State. So we're going to test that. You know, we'll have some that are over 2 pounds, and so we'll see if that kind of holds true, or if, like I said, this combination of calcium makes a difference. So I have more questions than answers, really, in this whole thing.
Hopefully at the end you'll have more answers.
Right.
No, you won't. You'll still then you'll just make more questions. Yeah. You just have new questions. Because there's even the Michigan State research, I think, is really interesting because they also talk about a pH interaction as well.
Yep.
That as we get into the 8 pHs, the boron availability declines. And so then you have a lot of questions with that. And so then some of that goes to, well, do I just apply more boron or do I apply something to decrease my pH, like elemental sulfur? So I think, Matt, you're going to have, you know, a lot more questions. There's even some research out there on that. I've always heard of calcium magnesium ratio, but they use the word calcium boron ratio.
Sure.
And that was new to me as well. And it says they, you know, do similar things in the plant and soil or you know, have similar roles, but obviously they're different, but you know, I've never heard that as even being a thing. So you might find in this as well that there's certain interactions of where the boron does work, but you need a certain amount of calcium there to make it work,
right, or to
do whatever. So it's, those are tricky where there's, you know, in research, we always try to have independent variables. So there's one thing you're really researching, but what's going to be tricky here is you have two independent variables that may be different at different times. So it's going to be hard to find out, you know, just to say, well, more boron's better until you get to this amount. It may not be the case that way.
Right. And that also leads us to, when you look at the investment in this kind of fertilization and the amount we're talking. So when we're looking at Aspire and alfalfa and stuff, we're not talking, you know, 5 pounds of boron. And I don't remember exactly how much boron is in it, but I don't think it's a lot. You guys remember it all?
Boron in what, say again?
In like Aspire, how much is...
You know, there's... I mean, you're getting... I want to say you got... Yeah, that one's a tricky one. Because usually we apply, say, 200 pounds of Aspire is a pretty common...
I always thought amount. The common thing was 200 pounds of Aspire gets you that 7 pounds of boron that you kind of target. It's a half of...
Yeah, 0.5 boron.
Yeah.
So if you're 200 pounds...
Gets you 10 pounds.
Well, it's 0.5 per.
That's where it's tricky.
Well, I went 0.05.
I do think some of these are tricky and just... Because, Matt, in your research, too, are you going to use... You know, a lot of them, like a lot of the Michigan State research, didn't show soybean yield increases, but they are using foliar boron. You, I believe, on this research are going to be using...
Yeah, we're going to use dry.
Dry.
Yep.
So dry boron, it's going to be different, too, of how you're getting it in the plant. Just all the hows are different with that. And I would think with the amount of boron you'll be able to apply with dry will be higher as well, which would be good. So,
yeah. So we'll see what kind of results we get. But obviously there's enough research out there and commentary on toxicity that it's not unheard of to have issues as a result of high levels of boron. So it is going to be kind of a trying to find that sweet spot of, you know, boron is good, can be a good thing, but too much of it can also be a problem because, I mean, we've had research that has shown what the symptoms of boron toxicity are. So it's not that it doesn't exist. It's just kind of a variable that we think we know where the line is, but adding this calcium to it may kind of raise that bar a little bit when it comes to soybeans, at least in this particular plot. But yeah, I'm interested to see where this all goes. Like we said at the top, boron's not really like a high priority. It's not unheard of, but it's not something that we're like usually looking at a field like, yeah. Boron. You need more boron. So yeah, I think it's an interesting...
You can tell when beans are short of manganese, like you said, Todd, or even potash for some degree. You can tell that. Boron, it's like, yeah, better take a tissue sample.
Right. So yeah, like I said, not a lot of answers, but just kind of interesting to, again, find the value of those micronutrients. And, you know, macros we pay a lot of attention to, but it's the micros sometimes that we need to look a little bit deeper at and see.
So bottom line, Matt, for more potting, more retention of pods, retention of flowers, if growers want to play around with right before flowering, adding some calcium and boron. I mean, that's the whole premise here of this talk is
right.
That the promote some more yield. Maybe we try this.
Yeah, could be an avenue to setting more pods. So,
what's out of boron deficiency? If you search the images of it, like you said, Bill, we know what some of these other ones look like. You just know boron deficiency to me looks like dicamba drift on soybeans.
Sure.
Not exactly, but it kind of like crinkles up the leaves a little bit, and yeah, just to me, it looks like some of it also has, you know, some whitish edges that get different, so it's not all like that, but it just has this sort of, you know, where it drawstrings the leaves.
Yep.
And well, would you agree with that, Bill?
Yeah, 100%. Yep.
It's one of those things, too, where if it's tied in with another deficiency, too, it's hard to, like, if you get manganese and boron deficient, you're probably going to err on the side of the manganese because it's a lot more visual.
Right.
And assume the crinkling is just an after effect of something.
Or you can
else.
Assume, like, well, or who sprayed,
who sprayed next to my beans?
Yeah. Oh, that could, yeah.
Oh, there's a cornfield next to her.
Right.
Yep.
Right. So that... Yeah, maybe we got a tissue sample at that time to see more so if you got boron deficiency and not dicamba drift.
Yeah. All right, so there you go. Some things to consider for applications of boron and maybe adding some calcium with it. Now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So two college students developed a solution, a potential solution, for farmers to control common crop pest. Aditya Prabhu says he and fellow University of Minnesota student James Duquette created Allure LLC because they recognize Japanese beetles are a problem throughout the Midwest. They feed on 300 different species of plants that include a lot of traditional agricultural plants that growers are tending throughout the summer, but can also affect gardeners too. I know I've seen them on anything from trees to, they really like green bean plants I found in our garden. So yeah, they're kind of a universal pest, not just in large scale agriculture, but small scale gardening as well. Most control methods require spraying them, so they can be expensive. If you're worried about toxicity and spraying insecticides, you know, that can give some people some pause, especially on the home garden side. But they've sourced and utilized safe insecticide-infused netting, which they place at regular intervals throughout the perimeter of a property. And then they've done some preliminary testing and found that those enclosures can attract and kill Japanese beetles within just 2 minutes of exposure. So it says the pilot projects for bait and kill products will take place this summer. And they were a finalist for the Schultz Entrepreneurship Challenge, which is a Shark Tank-like national competition that took place in April. So kind of cool. We'll see if it pans out for them.
It does remind, I mean, you see those bags hanging by tree, you know, that...
Yeah, a lot of fruit trees the other day.
Yeah, they'll catch them that way. And this is a similar way. It just has a net instead of the bag. And yeah, that's... Yeah,
it's cool. Yeah, so tracks and kills. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. All right, so today we're going to talk history of plant nutrition. So the history of plant nutrition can be traced back to the early 19th century when the concept of plant nutrition was first proposed. Before then, it was believed that plants grew by absorbing nutrients from the soil in which they were planted. However, experiments conducted by several scientists showed that plants required specific nutrients for their growth, and the absence of any of these nutrients could limit plant growth. 1840, German chemist Julius von Sachs conducted experiments that showed that plants required nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium for their growth. He also discovered that plants could absorb nutrients through their roots. In 1850, the English chemist John Bennett Laws and his collaborator Joseph Henry Gilbert established the world's first agricultural research station in Rothamsted in England. They conducted experiments that showed the importance of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. They also developed the first commercial fertilizer known as superphosphate, which was made by treating bones with sulfuric acid. In the early 20th century, soil scientist Sir Albert Howard developed the concept of organic farming, which emphasized the importance of maintaining soil health through the use of organic materials such as compost and green manure. In the 1920s and 30s, American plant physiologist Frederick Black discovered the role of trace elements in plant nutrition. He found that plants required small amounts of certain elements such as iron, zinc, and manganese for their growth, and probably boron too. Today, plant nutrition is an important part of research, and scientists continue to study the complex interactions between plants and their environments. Plant nutrition is critical for the production of healthy crops, and the development of new fertilizers and nutrient management strategies is essential for sustainable agriculture. So there you go. I thought this tied in nicely with the whole Liebig's barrel.
Yes,
and
yep.
Yeah. Kind of. His name actually came up a few times when I was looking at some ag history minute topics when it comes to fertilization and, you know, the laws of the minimum and all that, how it ties into having the right amount and the stave.
Well, and even dating back before that, and maybe we'll talk about this next week, but they just thought that they didn't know all the essential nutrients for
right.
a while. So they just thought like, well, no, like nature just, it's just like magic almost. Like it's just
yeah.
there.
Yeah, the barrel just gets bigger
yeah.
the further down the road we get right. with all this.
Great.
So,
great. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's very easy. Just search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts. Or on an Android phone, you need to download an app like Podcast Addict. And you can also listen on your smartphone or computer browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts. You can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
Thanks, Todd. Now we'll get into our Cool Beans That's Corny and some current events. So, Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week, former USDA Undersecretary for Food Safety says that negative beef tests for H5N1 came as no surprise. So, we've talked about the...
Was it no surprise, though? Where did they test it? They're not
right.
surprised.
It's better that they tested, but it just reinforces the idea that as far as consumption of meat, it's not going to pass through. So they did some background beef samples, 30 to be specific, in the National Veterinary Services Laboratory for PCR testing, and all of them came back negative, so no H5N1 virus particles present. Mindy Brashears, who was the U.S. DA Undersecretary for Food Safety and now a Horn Distinguished Professor at Texas Tech University, said, really, your meat is essentially sterile, so the muscle of the animal and the virus you usually would find in the GI tract or respiratory system, so she was not surprised that they did not find anything in the meat. So it's good that they did it, but...
Just don't eat the lungs.
Yes, don't eat the GI tract or the respiratory system.
Well, and it, like with milk, too, and eggs that they're pasteurized...
Yep.
That's important, too. So,
yes.
Yeah, it's something to remember with I don't know, Bill and I grew up on the day of raw milk, but...
Yep, we used to
drink
some, too,
of that.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's the food side of it is safe. You know, they've done the testing. They've checked all the boxes, I guess you could say. So milk, eggs, and meat are safe despite some herds seeing infections by H5N1. So, you know, it's something that, even though not this virus specifically, you know, they're constantly testing and looking for contaminants in meat supplies. That's why we have recalls when there are issues and everything else. So I guess just another way of reassuring people that the food supply is being kept safe. So it's always a good thing. All right, that's Corny this week, a 17-month review process is likely for the new dicamba label. So retailers wanting to sell dicamba-based products and for crop producers who want to use them, the 2024 final sale and use dates are approaching, if not passed. Some states are already past where they can be. May 13th was the last day for sales and distribution of existing stocks of over-the-top dicamba products for Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, Minnesota. The sales and distribution deadline for products in South Dakota is May 21st. And for all other states and counties with registration, the sales and distribution deadlines are May 31st for soybeans, June 30th for cotton. And no dicamba-based products can be applied to soybeans after June 30th. For cotton, that final cutoff date is July 30th. So enjoy it now, because 2025 may not get you anywhere. Potentially, may if it's 17 months, that's over a year. So it could be 2026 before we really see dicamba back on the market.
Soybean dicamba.
Soybean dicamba, yes, sorry. Not any dicamba. But soybean, cotton, yeah, any of the, essentially the Xtend family of traded products and products used to spray over those transgenic crops. All right, and we'll wrap things up then with our Field Good Friday for the day. An Indiana dairy farmer took place in the Indianapolis 500 tradition. And that was American Dairy Association of Indiana's veteran milkman, Alex Neuschwander. He will hand the winning driver of the Indianapolis 500 a cold glass bottle of milk. Fourth-generation dairy farmer says this is a great way to feature milk in front of millions of race fans. So as dairy farmers, we work really hard to take good care of our cows, he said, just like the race driver, car drivers. They have a pit crew, and we have a pit crew. I mean, just so many things we have in common with the race, and it's a really fun tradition, I'm assuming, of the milkers or the pit crew in that scenario. But, yeah, Abby Herr, a fourth-generation dairy farmer from Kendenville, Indiana, is the 2024 rookie milkwoman. Rookie delivers bottles to the winning chief mechanic and winning team owner. So kind of cool that they tie dairy in with the big race there. So they'll be up bright and early getting the milk ready. And tradition began in Victory Circle in 1936 by Lewis Meyer when he asked for a glass of buttermilk after his victory. The bottle of milk has evolved into a ceremonial race day tradition to an Indiana dairy farmer handing it off to the Indy 500 champion. So pretty cool. We should start doing that after football games, like bring them out some chocolate milk, some right. Recovery.
It's a very simple origin story. Like, just the guy's like, hey, I want some milk.
Yeah. Give me some buttermilk.
Really thirsty. And
buttermilk. Like, drinking buttermilk is not really...
That's thick stuff right there. It's like, I want some, real thick buttermilk after riding in a hot car for...
500 hours. Yeah. 500 miles.
Yeah, that's kind of a cool thing, neat for those farmers. And
it's cool it still happens today, too. Like, yeah. Pretty quick, it'll be 100 years of that happening, so
yeah,
it's good.
All right, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about boron and, you know, deficiency and toxicity issues that can come with that. In our spotlight, we took a look at a new product that could help solve the Japanese beetle issue for farmers and gardeners alike. Ag History Minute, we talked the history of plant nutrition and the realization of the necessity of macro and micronutrients. Cool Beans this week was testing done on beef shows no H5N1 in the meat, which is a good thing. And our That's Corny this week, potential 17-month review process for new dicamba labels. Moving forward, and our Field Good Friday, Indiana dairy farmers get to hand off milk to the winners of the Indianapolis 500. A long-time tradition that continues today. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.